Welcome to Car Stuff, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hello again, all of you Car Stuff head gaskets. This is Kurt Guerin coming to you from the sidecar of the out-of-control Car Stuff motorcycle as we careen down the highway of life. Ben is to my left behind the handlebars at full throttle, and I suspect he is out of his mind on coffee. And me, well, here I sit, leather helmet and goggles firmly affixed to my noggin, face forward facing the onslaught of the chilly mid-fall air, completely unable to influence what this madman next to me is about to do. But hey, what can you do? Welcome to another wild ride here in the land of car stuff. Ben, can you hear me over there?
Yes, Kurt, I can hear you. Thank you again for having me back on the air, although I am not 100% on board with that description of me as an unhinged, coffee-fueled lunatic. I cannot object to its accuracy. We had a lot of conversations off-air, you and I, didn't we, after our previous episode on the cars of Breaking Bad?
Well, yes, we did.
We talked about, We really took some pot shots at the poor old Pontiac Aztec in particular. But during that exploration, you and I started talking about some cars we love and some cars we hate. Mm-hmm. Longtime Car Stuff listeners will recall my very, very complicated hate-hate relationship with a particular minivan known as the Honda Odyssey. You mm-hmm. and I have talked about
yes.
this. Did
yes.
we talk about this on air last time?
I don't think we were on air when we were talking about it. And since then, I had one negative experience with an Odyssey, and it may be in line with some of yours, but please continue.
No, please. Come with me.
Well, you know, it was just... it was one of those road situations where mm-hmm. you're just trying to make some progress and there's this one person that doesn't want you to. So, and they just happen to be in a Honda Odyssey.
You know what happened? The word's out. They know that you and I work together now. I'm telling you, there's a vast and insidious conspiracy. You know, jokes aside, I want to thank everybody over the years who has sent me wonderful email about wonderful Facebook messages, tweets, and so on about the Honda Odyssey, about minivans in general. And there's a very weird commercial that some of your coworkers and I filmed a while back about minivans. I've got to send you, or maybe we can post it on Car Stuff's Facebook page too. But with that being said, jokes aside, here's the beef with Honda Odysseys. When you buy a Honda, now this is a true story, Kurt. When you buy a Honda Odyssey at a dealership, you know, you get, engine-wise, it's a pretty good vehicle, right? Spec-wise, pretty good vehicle. If you're a person who feels like there's no such thing as too many cup holders, Honda Odyssey, that's the ride for you. But if you have a problem with the price point or something like that, the dealer takes you into a back room and they say, hey, we're going to give you a discount on this van so long as you let us install this one extra feature. And this feature recognizes when there's a guy named Ben Bolin in a Monte Carlo within about a half mile of you, and it slows your vehicle down and makes sure, like this weird autonomous system, makes sure that you're directly in front of his car. Hmm. And, you know, understandably, people buying a Honda Odyssey are like, well, you're going to knock $5,000 off the price, then of course I'll do it.
Sure.
So that's my beef with them.
Yeah, and they must have updated the software on that particular piece,
too. Now they're after you.
Yeah.
Well, what's a car that you particularly love, Kurt?
Well, off the top of my head, an El Camino comes to mind.
Ah, you've hit upon the topic of today's episode. So behind the scenes, this is a weird one. Behind the scenes, when you and I were working on our previous episode on the cars of Breaking Bad, we also talked about the spinoff film to Breaking Bad that came out called El Camino. And at some point, I don't know if we ever mentioned this on air, man, but at some point we were both baffled that there'd never been a Car Stuff episode on El Camino, or as we call it here in the U.S., the El Camino, which should be hilarious to anyone who speaks a lick of Spanish, because what we're saying is the road. You know, it's like saying ATM machine or VIN number, right? Vehicle identification number. The El Camino, man, by the way, I'm going to continue calling it the El Camino for the entire time. The El Camino is a fascinating vehicle. It's sometimes like a platypus of the road. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not quite fish. It's not quite fowl. It's something different, something unique, a mixtape. And you and I have some personal stories about the El Camino, but I have the following proposition. Why don't we start with the origin story of the actual vehicle, which may surprise some people. Some 80s babies may be surprised how old this vehicle actually is.
El Camino was introduced, the first generation was introduced in 1959. It was basically a response to Ford's Ranchero. But even before that, in Australia in the 30s, they created this vehicle known as the coupe utility. So the idea of a car that had some of the attributes of a truck, the idea of that was around for a while before they started showing up in America. And even in the early 50s, Chevy and Ford made light-duty trucks. Mm-hmm. Like the Chevys made a truck called the Task Force. It was a light-duty pickup truck. But the El Camino brought in some of that, I guess, the elegant lines of the late 50s and early 60s, the chrome trim, some of the more visually appealing aspects of the sedans at the time.
Yeah, you can look at some pictures of the first generation El Caminos, and you can clearly see the aesthetic you're talking about here, Kurt. I do have to also confess, I have a weakness for those flowing lines, that space age retro futurism so common in Fords and Chevys of the 50s and into the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a previous episode on car stuff about Utes in Australia and their origin. For anybody who wants to check that out, there's a really cool quote that you found about the Ute as well from like the way it was marketed in Australia, right?
Yeah, so it was a farmer's wife in Victoria, Australia. She desired a car that, quote, to go to church in on a Sunday in which to carry our pigs to market on Mondays.
And so that encapsulates the entire concept here. You know what I mean? The idea that instead of buying two separate vehicles for two separate specific tasks, right, you can buy something that fulfills both of those functions. This is a question that we'll come back to, right? Because what we're going to see here is going to be ultimately a battle between some of those functions. Like, is a daily driver or your good-looking car, right, your business car, is that the same thing as your hauler, your work vehicle? The folks who made the Cameo Carrier and the folks who made the El Camino and the folks who made the Utes in general, their answer to that was, yes, it can be the same thing. Forward the future. What a time to be alive. You know what I mean? So let's dive in a little bit into the first generation of, try not to crack up when I say this, the El Camino. The road.
It was based on a station wagon that Chevrolet produced at the time. It was the Brookwood station wagon. So the first generation spanned 2 years, 1959 to 1960. And throughout the generations, by the way, the El Camino, it kind of flip-flops back and forth between car, muscle car, light utility, truck, and it kind of has this funny quest of finding its place where it fits in the car universe, I guess. And maybe ultimately that's why it disappeared, because it was just kind of always that it sat in the middle somewhere between car and truck, obviously, but also between car that you would want to be in every day to a car that you may have had to have another car to seat maybe more than 2 to 3 people.
Right.
If you
Unless
wanted
you
to.
Want them riding in the bed.
True. Which became unacceptable at some point.
I know, for some reason.
I don't know when, yeah.
Right? Which, you know, you and I both probably grew up in areas where it was completely normal to just hop in the back of the pickup truck, right?
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah.
For sure.
So I like that we're starting with the first generation here. And I like that you mentioned the Ranchero earlier, because the El Camino, That's the last time I'm going to laugh at saying that. The El Camino was a little edgier. It was more stylized. It was hipper than the Ranchero. And when it first came out, it sold more quickly than the Ranchero. Something along the lines of like 22,000 to 14,000. And then it also, while it was clearly based on the Brookwoods wagon, it had some different variants. You had some more options. You could get it with any full-size Chevy drivetrain. It had a single trim level. And then we can dive into the stats a little bit. Let's look at the price point. So the 1960 model, next model year, still has that kind of classic, or what would come to be classic, Bel Air look, right? Mm-hmm. Of the 1959. But how much did it cost?
The starting price was around $2,366, and that was with the six-cylinder engine. You could also get a V8 for around $100 more, which was a 283 cubic inch engine.
So let's do just a little bit of inflation calculator math. You ready? All right, let's see. Let me get a drum roll here. $2,366 in 1960 is equivalent to about $20,071.58 in 2018. So $20,000 functionally. That's nothing to sneeze at. That's definitely an investment, especially when you consider that these weren't super practical for a lot of people in the U.S.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, for sure. Especially around the time, the baby boomer generation. So you had larger nuclear families after World War II.
Right.
And you needed space for the kids.
And you know, one thing you told me that I thought was very interesting was you said, when I look at the first generation El Camino, I'm also kind of seeing the story about the time,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it seems like you step back and you look at the El Camino throughout the generations, it directly reflects the time that it was produced. And that kind of sounds obvious. If you look at any car through any generation, you could say that. However, the uniqueness of the El Camino being a car truck kind of makes it, it's just interesting to see what the manufacturer made the El Camino. It's like, do we make it more like a car? Do we make it more like a truck? Do we make it a muscle car?
Right.
Do we make it an economy car? So in general, the general look of the car, the general feel of the car, you can tell where the industry was at the time. And that is kind of neat about the El Camino, for sure.
Right. And we're looking at this hybridization, right? Again, two separate vehicle concepts smooshed together into one thing. You could make an argument here that the El Camino has always been a little more car than it is truck, right?
I would say so.
It's strange because the big truck parts or truck aspects, attributes, for lack of a better word, of the El Camino are going to be the bed and the fact that it's a two-seater. Those are the defining traits. And most of the other stuff, all car. By way of contrast, we can look at another attempt of compromise, something that is incredibly prevalent in modern pickup trucks today, which is the extended cab.
Mm-hmm.
We're coming toward the same thing from a very different direction. Since this is an audio podcast, I want everybody listening to know that what I'm doing is staring off into the middle distance, completely out of my mind and caffeine, gesticulating wildly with my two hands about to like slap together, because the extended cab pickup is trying to also function as a family vehicle. And in some cases, it's doing it successfully. You can comfortably seat a family of four to five in an extended cab, right? Depending on the make, model, et cetera. With the El Camino, there's not an extended cab. It's just the two seats and the pickup. But like you said, and I love this idea, man, like you said, we can conduct a bit of forensic work based on the way that the El Camino evolves or has changed with successive generations, we can also see the way American culture is changing, or at least car manufacturers' perception of American car cultures.
There was a gap, first of all, between the first and second generation of a couple years. However, when the Ranchero continued success in the two-year absence, so the Chevys said, well, okay, well, let's take another stab at it. So they began to base the El Camino on the Chevelle. It definitely has a scaled-back appearance, as the Chevelle did at the time. The Chevelle is a smaller muscle car type vehicle. So Chevy began to make a car that was leaning in that direction. So leaning away from luxury, headed towards performance, but not quite there yet.
We've got this interesting thing here because now we're moving from two unrelated functions, right? Family, daily driver, work vehicle, hauler. We're moving from two unrelated functions toward two functions that are arguably oppositional. A high-performance vehicle is built to avoid weight,
right,
and a hauling vehicle is built to move with as much weight as reasonably possible. So this is one of the areas where we see the contradiction of design in the El Camino come to the forefront, is in the second gen. However, do want to point out, they still look very cool.
They do. Yeah. As far as weight and weight distribution, it is interesting to have a muscle car with little weight on the rear wheels.
Yeah.
You know, so, but I guess you could put some weight back there if you wanted to. Yeah, sure. In 1964, when the second generation was introduced, it was initially introduced with a six-cylinder engine. But very soon after that, they were throwing V8s in there. I think the 327 cubic inch was a V8 engine.
Yep, yep.
350 horsepower. So not slack there. So throughout the years, 64 till the second generation ended in 1967, they dramatically increased power and function to get towards the third generation. They changed the dashboard layout to horizontal speedometer, which was becoming popular at the time.
I remember when growing up, I was driving some of my older relatives' older cars that had the horizontal speedometer.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that freaked me out is maybe just the illusion or the spatial reasoning involved. I started thinking less in terms of the numbers, more in terms of where this thing is, right? And like where the indicator is. And that's a terrible way to think about driving, because I'm like, well, as long as it's, you know, as long as it's not all the way to the right, we're fine. We're not really speeding. We're only speeding if it's laying down completely flat on the right. Don't try that at home, kids.
And the culmination of the generation in 67, they introduced the collapsible steering column. Disc brakes were now an option. They included an automatic transmission as an option. And they also introduced rear air shocks, which would raise and lower the rear end.
We're in this plus, minus, plus, you know, pro con pro kind of situation here. Collapsible steering column, great. Disc brakes, thank God. Also, you know, I hope this is not a hot take, but having an automatic on a muscle car, I don't feel like that's the right move, especially considering that's a 1967 automatic. The El Camino at this point is a muscle car that has the handicap of a pickup bed. Now, I'll say it because that's what it is. If you think of a muscle car mission, it has a handicap. The center cannot hold. This is an unsustainable situation. I don't know. It's interesting because we see from the second generation on that the El Camino does have its own evolution, but it's also following the Chevelle's evolution. A change in the Chevelle affects a change in the El Camino. Mm-hmm. And this holds true for the third generation, right?
Yeah, so third generation ranged from 1968 to 1972. And yeah, the design changed along with the Chevelle options, paralleled the Chevelle's options over the years. This one will be familiar. I mean, this is the muscle car generation.
Yeah.
These are the years of the muscle car El Camino right here. So the second generation was kind of walking us up to this point. Society was changing. The baby boomer children of the early 50s were starting to drive, and this is what they wanted.
And
I
they look
imagine.
Mean, too. I like it.
This particular generation of El Camino and Chevelle, very beautiful cars. Mm-hmm. The body style did change between the 1969 and 70 year. Oddly enough, it's the same generation. there's a big difference between those two. Even when we're talking Chevelle, the 70 Chevelle, that was the year, man. That was like the year that had the gigantic engine in it.
That's the 350 V8, right?
Well, it's a 454.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, because 350 V8 was 1969. Yeah.
Yeah. So they bumped it up 454, 450 horsepower. This is the very end of that muscle car, unrestricted. No worries about gas mileage, none of that garbage.
right. Yeah.
We're just going to see if how big of an engine we can put in the car, and then we're just going to put it in there. Yeah, so it's a beautiful thing. But rewinding back to 68 a little bit, so the El Camino was based on the four-door Chevelle station wagon / sedan. It was bigger, yet lighter than the previous generation, which if you were to look at it, it would be hard to believe that.
We also know that this was, 68 was the year the Super Sport was launched, right? Super Sport version?
Yeah, so that was a 396 cubic inch El Camino SS.
One thing interesting that you pointed out to me here is that there was a noticeable engineering problem or design problem with the 69 model.
Yeah, so they put the backup lights, they moved them from the rear bumper up to the bed. So if the tailgate was down, you couldn't see the backup lights.
You know, wait, maybe it was on purpose. Maybe they were like, you know what you really need when you're reversing this car? You need to be kind of a wild card. People need to not know where you're going and what you're doing.
Exactly.
Is he going forward, backward? Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, keep life interesting.
Exactly. Why not? Why not? Yeah. And of course, when you're driving the SS version, you would want to leave that tailgate down. Because if you left it up, I'd believe the airflow might be a little bit restricted.
Yeah, it's like that, what do the kids call it? The Naruto run? You heard of that one? It's some thing on the internet where people are saying that if you run with your arms pointed out behind you, you run faster. I haven't checked into the science, you know, I'm not.
I'm not buying that.
Yeah.
Just from a mechanical standpoint, it doesn't seem like it would be the best way to run. But further research is necessary, though.
There we go. And when we get to 1970, the El Camino, it's bittersweet, right? Because this is, I think we can both agree, this is the apex moment. This is the highest performing El Camino, at least maybe not in terms of sales, but in terms of its on-the-road abilities. It has some drawbacks, depending on where you put the tailgate. No one knows if you're going to go forward or backward. And also, it's officially a muscle car. It ticks the boxes of a muscle car, but it's a muscle car that happens to have a pickup truck on its butt.
Right. Yeah.
So what happened that stopped this clear trend? Because if we're being honest, we see from 1964 all the way up to 1970, we see this clear trend toward building more performance into the front end.
Mm-hmm.
It's becoming more and more muscle car, also, you know, kind of following the market at the time, but it still has this pickup truck bed that's becoming more and more of a legacy, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of like an interesting novelty attached to the El Camino. So there's something that happens right around 1970.
What you're getting at would be fuel regulations, lower octane fuel, mm-hmm. a more fuel economy-centric mindset in the United States. I don't think the gas crisis had fully kicked in yet, but the writing was on the wall. The car was changing forever.
Yeah.
And American car companies were about to jump on the bandwagon or get left behind. This was it. This was the end of the muscle car as we know it.
So
as we knew it.
Yeah, as we knew it. Yeah. So in 71, lower octane unleaded fuel mandates are in effect. And this means that the El Caminos from 71 on start using lower compression engines, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we see, oddly enough, despite these mandates, we see that the GMC Spirit is introduced this year.
Which is GMC's counterpart to the El Camino.
And, you know, other than those regulations, not too much like fundamental There aren't too many fundamental shifts in design or in specs until we get to the fourth generation, which I know a lot of us listening have been waiting for.
The fourth generation was from 1973 to 1977. So 1973 saw a dramatic redesign of the El Camino. It still was based on the Chevelle station wagon, and it was the largest El Camino to this point ever produced. Probably the largest El Camino ever produced, because I believe the next generation is a little smaller.
Yeah.
Front discs are now also standard in 73. So, Ben, why in particular do you say that this generation is special in terms of our story here?
This version of the El Camino is one that I think a lot of people growing up or our age are probably familiar with. This is also, I've got some personal bias here, Kurt, because this is also the first El Camino that I had experience with. And that was a 19, I want to say it was a 76 with the quad headlights. My father had gotten into a very serious argument with a guy that he was getting this El Camino from. And the argument, which was with a coworker of his, went this way. The coworker said, "Let me just give this to you. Just take it out of my yard. My wife is so pissed that this thing is sitting here. It takes like, you know, it takes like a quart of oil to get it anywhere. It's in bad shape. It's what we, it's a huge POS. Since we're a family show, that means piece of stuff or piece of stink, whatever you want to call it." And so on the other side of this, my dad, the old man, is like, it's like, "No, I can't do that. We have to have the title. There has to be an exchange of money. I want to give you at least $100. And so after they had this drag out argument of just take it, I'll feel bad, I will just, let me give you some money. This became like our work vehicle for taking care of the yard, moving stuff around. And this thing was in my mind, because very old when we got it, this thing was in my mind our Flintstones car, because the shotgun seat had a hole in the undercarriage that had plywood over it. And I kept trying to convince my dad to let me move the plywood, to let you know how old I was at the time, so that I could do the Flintstones. By which, yes, it is as dumb an idea as it sounds today. The idea was, I was like, I'm going to put my feet through it and then I'm going to run along with the car. The reason I still have feet today is because, thank God, there was an adult around to convince me. My parents took a very interesting tack with this. They said, they didn't try to convince me that I couldn't do it or tell me that I couldn't do it. They did tell me, obviously, but they didn't try to convince me that that itself was a bad idea because of the physics involved. Instead, they convinced me, first off, they told me they would, from the era of corporal punishment. So they made it clear there would be consequences if I tried to do this. And then they also got in my head, man, and they convinced me that the Flintstones was a crappy cartoon.
No.
And by doing that, you know, they made it uncool for us to want to do this. But this thing had a drinking problem, but with oil. And it was one of those things where we thought, you know, forget Blue Book value, because whenever you're fixing a used car, you always want to compare it to the value of the vehicle, right?
Yeah, right.
And this thing was scrap metal that happened to be held together by duct tape, wire, some prayers to a higher power. Eventually, my dad ended up giving it away, but I will always remember that 76 El Camino, because I was certain, I was a kid at the time, but I was certain that when I got to be 16 years old, this would be the car I was going to drive. And I thought I was going to be like hot stuff, you know,
yeah,
at the
man.
High school parking lot.
Yeah.
But you also had some experience growing up with El Caminos, right?
I did. I want to rewind, though, for a second and ask you if there's a story as to why that hole was in the floorboard on the passenger side.
You know, it was clearly not an intentionally made hole. It looked kind of like rusted.
So rust had gotten to it that quick.
I don't know the story the Flintstone shotgun hole. You know what? How about this? I will check and get back to everybody on that, because the weirdest things seem normal when you're a kid.
Yeah.
And looking back in my 30s, I'm thinking, yeah, it's unusual for a car to have a hole in the undercarriage like that.
Well, did y'all drive it around, other than from here to there around the house? Did y'all drive it out to the store? And
yeah, like maybe around the block and the community and the neighborhood.
It wasn't really
to like
a daily driver?
Home Depot or something. Yeah, no. Very much. Like you would haul sod in it and stuff like that.
Yeah, I feel like those types of cars, people used to have those types of cars.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And not many people retain a car now just to kind of
do,
you know,
the,
what I mean?
Yeah,
like the car with the hole
car.
In the floor, you know?
Right, right. The beater.
Yeah, the beater.
Yeah.
So the era of the beater is kind of over.
This is an interesting thing that you bring up, and it touches on a larger concept here. You're right. A lot of people just have a daily driver now, right?
Yeah.
And I think part of that is because we know that the entry-level price for a new car, don't ever buy a brand new car, by the way. We know the entry-level price for a newer car, just a sedan, not even a bunch of bells and whistles, that price seems to continually rise, you know? And maybe part of it is that we also see more people living in cities, so they're living with less land.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to think that the death of the beater has been, the news of the death of the beater, to quote Mark Twain, has been greatly exaggerated. Because in rural areas, in the countryside and stuff, you still need a vehicle like that. You know what I mean? You still have to go off the road. You have to go into a field, or you have to haul some messy, heavy stuff. And what are you going to do? You're going to take the nice car? Are you going to screw up the nice car? That's how I always think of it. I don't have a beater right now. Wait, no, that's not true. I do have a beater. It's my daily driver. It's my Monte Carlo.
Yeah. So my personal story has to do with the next generation. So we're looking at the fifth generation.
Oh, yeah.
So the 1978 to 1987. Now it's based on the Malibu, or at least in the early part of this generation, it was based on the Malibu. This is the one that I think of when I think of El Camino. My grandfather pretty much exclusively drove this. We used to do a lot of fishing.
Okay.
So this was perfect for carrying all that gear and going out into on the tight dirt roads.
And now this one is based on the Malibu, correct?
Back to the start of this generation in 1978, the El Camino had its own unique chassis for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't based off of the actual undercarriage of any particular car. You can kind of tell by looking at it, it's a different stature. It doesn't seem like a car stature.
Yeah. So this is where we see this fifth generation based on the Chevy Malibu for a while. It's generally based on the GM G platform or the G body. And the day of the muscle car El Camino is long gone by this point, right? And now people are focusing more on economy of fuel. Right. And when we say people here, we mean car manufacturers. We don't necessarily mean drivers, because anybody who wanted a muscular El Camino is holding on to it for dear life, right?
Speaking of fuel, from 82 to 84, a diesel engine was included in the El Camino. It was an Oldsmobile engine. I believe it became known for reliability issues. However, it did have some signs of life back to towards the muscle car, towards the SS. Even though this generation of El Camino was based on the Malibu, there were SS models made by Choo Choo Customs.
Yeah.
So they were commissioned by Chevrolet to make these cars. Choo Choo Customs was based in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and the El Caminos that they produced had more of a Monte Carlo front end. A lot of people may be familiar with this, but it technically is the same body, same generation as the Malibu-based El Camino. It just kind of has a different nose clip on it. There were no performance modifications. This was purely a visual aesthetic upgrades, but very iconic-looking vehicles. It made for a nice-looking El Camino.
On the way to the El Camino's demise, there were a lot of pitches, internal and external, for ideas of resurrecting or reinventing the El Camino. And that makes sense, because since Its first generation, the El Camino has continually been kind of reinvented as people try to figure out, should this be more truck? Should this be more car? Can we put these two things together in an effective way?
So the end of the El Camino era in 87, shortly before that, production was moved to Mexico. So the writing was on the wall there. In the early 80s, the S10 was introduced. So it was filling that small truck category. And then fast forward to the 90s when some of these concepts started showing up. The SUV was starting to creep in to the picture then. Ford had the Bronco and Chevy had the Blazer and GMC had the Jimmy. And those cars evolved. And really, the manufacturers haven't looked back since then.
Yeah, you're right. Before the demise of the El Camino and even after it went to Mexico to die, like Ambrose Bierce. Even before that occurred, GM in particular kept reworking ideas for possible resurrections of the El Camino, new iterations thereof, and so on. In 1992, they unveiled this concept car, El Camino. It was more or less a pickup version of the Chevy Lumina. You can imagine how ugly it looked. Just take a second to imagine that, folks. Yes, correct. You win the prize. It was just as ugly as you imagine. There was a Pontiac G8 ST concept that they showed at the 2008 New York Auto Show. I'm going to show you this one, Kurt. What do you think? Just initial reactions?
It's pretty ugly.
it's
Aztec ugly.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's our new, you know what? I propose that's our new rating system. If something's especially ugly, it's Aztec ugly.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just it's the platypus problem. Mm-hmm. It's trying to be two different things at that point. However, I would argue that for a time, during a certain period of the El Camino's rise and its fall, it did somehow, maybe not 100%, but somehow it kind of like 70 to 80% nailed what it was trying to do. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a secret that I would love for the El Camino to return. I think it would be cool if it was done right.
I don't think we are alone in yearning for the return of at least a small pickup, light-duty pickup.
Yeah.
Maybe even the El Camino, but hey, we can't get too greedy here.
right.
But at least a small truck. It seems like if you want, and this goes for cars too, if you want a small truck or a small car, they're either comically small or they're way too big. If you can't reach behind you and tap on the glass, then you're not driving a small truck.
If you look at things like the best small trucks for 2019, you know, you go to any auto blog or even Jalopnik or CarMax or whatever, you'll see that a lot of them still have extended cabs. Mm-hmm. Having an extended cab, to me, does not make it a small truck. Mm-hmm. We are seeing this trend, and it happened with the Mini Cooper as well. Mm-hmm. We're seeing this trend toward bigger and bigger things. There's this mission creep in the footprint of a vehicle. I am not in any way, shape, or form saying that there's something wrong with big vehicles. You need vehicles with that horsepower, with that firepower sometimes. But like you're saying, man, for anybody who wants a small pickup truck, it's a little two-seater, you know, okay, maybe with that pretend middle seat that no one ever wants to use. So let's just call it a two-seater. If you want one of those right now, you don't have a ton of viable alternatives. Before I was brought out of cryo sleep and returned to car stuff here, I was listening to some of the recent episodes that you and Scott had done. And one thing that I think is particularly relevant to this conversation is the earlier episode about the Ford Ranger, since it was out of commission from, 2011? You guys asked a really good question, like, will this Ranger actually be the small pickup truck people want? We just pulled this up on our Car Stuff community Facebook page, and we're seeing some pretty good conversations here. Rudy M. notes that the Ranger Raptor is available as a factory model and has a pretty good review of it, says it's tough as nails, includes all the extras. Alex S. says the new Ranger is too big and too expensive. Whatever happened to the small, basic, simple trucks?
There you go.
And I think that's what they're... I think that's what they're going for. And you can see the conversation when Alex S. continues on in the conversation, says, the new Rangers are the size the F-150 used to be. I don't want a truck that big. I just want the old Ranger size.
It's just unfortunate that we don't get to decide what the automakers make. A lot of the options they include in the cars now, they're outdated several years after they're introduced, like the displays and things like that.
Yeah.
It just seems like we're steering in that direction towards more automation in cars.
Yeah.
And having a basic pickup truck doesn't fit into that model. I hate to say it,
mm-hmm.
but there may be a day when we're not driving our cars anymore.
I hear you, man. And it's something that honestly bugs me more than a little bit, because this is an ongoing dilemma I've had here. Okay, let's get apocalyptic real quick, right? So imagine there's something where some sort of a global event occurs where there's like an EMP, right? An electromagnetic pulse,
mm-hmm.
disables all computers, electronic devices, what have you. Older cars past a certain age will work because they're purely mechanical devices,
mm-hmm.
right? I've been looking increasingly toward getting a new car, which I hate to do. I'm probably going to keep the Monte Carlo. I'll make it a full-time beater. But I've been looking at this, and one thing that's disconcerting is there's this tendency, or there's this increasing trend of cars being made such that the owner is not allowed to work on certain aspects or components of the system.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that shows us that is just one aspect of our society's increasing move away from an ownership society toward a service society.
Technology's like that already. Computers are becoming where you can't replace components anymore. Everything's affixed to this circuit board, basically.
Right.
So yeah, cars are going that way too. In the design of the vehicle, they can say it performs a certain way, it gets this kind of gas mileage,
sure.
and they can regulate certain components of the car just to last longer. I mean, a lot of it is for our own good.
True.
But a lot of it does restrict, it restricts a lot of the things you can do, a lot of the modifications that you can do.
Yeah, exactly. I never thought it would be a hot take to say, I think that when you buy something, you should own it and you should be able to do what you want with it. I never in a million years thought that would be a controversial opinion, but apparently a lot of car manufacturers disagree with me. I wonder what they think about the El Camino too. And I'm dragging them a little bit, but a lot of these high level manufacturing decisions are made after extensive research. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So you and I are talking about what we like, what we want as drivers, and what they're thinking about is a decision that can make or lose billions of dollars for
mm-hmm.
them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they're coming at it from a different direction.
Well, and also when we get nostalgic about cars, when car fans get nostalgic about cars, they tend to think of the older days as being the better days. Cars are more beautiful. The engines were more powerful, sounded better.
Mm-hmm.
The exhaust smells, you know. So as time has gone on, though, cars have gotten a lot more fuel efficient. You can now buy a car new or a used car with very few miles on it, and you could drive it relatively maintenance free for 150,000 to 200,000 miles before you would have to change, before you would have to consider a major repair. As long as you do your basic maintenance,
yeah,
fluids, things like that,
uh-huh.
Spark plugs
all
and filters and all that stuff, you're good to go. And now that has not been the case in the past. We've gotten to this point now where tolerances are just so strict that it's really making for better cars in a way, but it is also taking some of that romanticism away. I always think of now, try to try to ask this question, which cars are we going to look at in 30, 40, 50 years and say, like, man, that car is classic?
I think about that too. You know, it's also a function of time. You're bringing up some really great points here, man, because so there were other vehicles around during the reign of the Model T. Model T is widely considered a classic. It's a function of its age, and it's also a function of its prevalence, its ubiquity. There were just so many Model Ts around that you're more likely to find one in the wild. So with that in mind, maybe we would ask, let's see, what would be an interesting example? So the Honda Civic, right? First Honda Civic comes out in 72, and it becomes... it eventually becomes for a number of years, the most popular car in the United States, like several decades down the road. Mm-hmm. But when it becomes the most popular car in the United States, it also becomes one of the most stolen vehicles in the United States because you can, you know, chop it down and you can sell the parts and there'll always be someone to buy it because their odds of owning a Honda Civic or needing to repair one are so much higher. So I wonder, would a Honda Civic eventually be a classic? It's tough because now we're trying to think what future historians, future car buffs will explore, mm-hmm. you know, and what they will value. Like, I'm going to be honest, man. I know I keep whinging and moaning about this Monte Carlo, this automotive albatross around my neck. But the fact of the matter is that I am going to keep it and wait until I can get those special license plates, man, and not have to take it to emissions ever. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's a good look. So I'm going to at least keep that beater until it's an antique. And then, you know, I don't know, maybe when I'm 80, I can sell it.
Yeah, I mean, car collecting in the future, you know, again, it's hard to predict, but right. Like, what will that be? Will the El Camino be back eventually? Who knows? Mm-hmm. It's just not looking good. It's not looking good for the El Camino. It's not looking good for the small truck, but we could start a small revolution here.
Maybe.
With
maybe
our car right. stuff gearheads yeah. and lug nuts.
And gasket heads alike.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode, folks. Kurt and I would like to hear from you. First off, big question, should the El Camino be resurrected or something like it? Second question, are there any other vehicles that you would like to see back on the road? If so, what are they and why? Last question for me, at least, small pickup trucks. Not the ones being marketed as small pickup trucks today, and these are modern times, but actual small pickup trucks. Should they come back? Should they not? Why? Would you get one? Let us know.
You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at CarStuffHSW.
You can also check out every single episode of Car Stuff that Kurt, Scott, and I have ever done on our website, carstuffshow.com. And let me tell you, folks, there's a ton of stuff out there. You can listen to that Ute episode we mentioned at the top for free, which is my favorite number.
And thanks, everyone, for listening, and we will see you next time with more Car Stuff goodies.
Car Stuff is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.